This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 3, 2004, at the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Democrats say that Congress should appoint members to Bush's newly announced independent investigation team to ensure a credible investigation of pre-war intelligence. Today is primary day in seven states. We look at how Native Americans have been shut out of the process in the Southwest. And another police killing of an African-American youth in Brooklyn, New York, brings large community protests. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Capitol Hill was virtually shut down today after ricin was found on a piece of mail addressed to Senator Bill Frist's office. Ricin, a toxic compound that comes from castor beans, is created through an additional extraction process when making castor oil. It can be inhaled, ingested, or injected, and has no antidote. More than 15 exposed workers have been decontaminated. This is the second time that a poisonous substance has made its way to the Capitol. In October of 2001, the office of Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle received an envelope laced with anthrax. Further investigations of the 2001 incident has not led to any arrests or convictions. However, the anthrax substance has been linked to an FBI lab. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has made it clear he will go forward with a plan to evacuate 7,500 Jewish settlers from 17 settlements in Gaza Strip. From Gaza City, Mohammed Galgini reports.
Sharon announced his plan in an interview with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz on Monday. The Prime Minister failed to mention any similar withdrawal from all of the West Bank settlements. However, his spokesperson did hint on a parallel plan to give a future Palestinian state control of Arab towns in Israel in exchange for the Jewish settlements on the West Bank. 7,500 settlers live on 30% of the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the settlement population of the West Bank is 400,000 settlers, controlling almost 40% of the land. There were mixed reactions to the plan. Extreme right-wing political parties in Israel said they would bring down Sharon's government if he went forward with the plan. The left-wing Labour Party said they would back him. Palestinian Prime Minister Qureh said the plan was good news, but it had to be followed by a similar move in the West Bank. Mohammed Ghalayini, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Lakota tribal member Arlo Looking Cloud's trial begins today in Rapid City, South Dakota. Looking Cloud is accused, along with John Graham, a member of Canada's First Nations tribes, in the murder of American Indian Movement activist Anime Pictou Aquash. From South Dakota, Jim Kent reports.
The body of Anime Pictou Aquash was found in a ravine on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation on February 24, 1976. It took two autopsies to locate the bullet wound in the back of her head and 27 years to track down her alleged killers. Annie Mae, as many call the Mi'kmaq tribal member, first came to prominence during the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee. It's been conjectured for years that her close ties with the inner workings of the American Indian Movement is what led to her execution. Navajo Marley Shabala says Anna Mae was a symbol of leadership for Native women long before her brutal death.
As a woman, as an activist, as a mother, as someone who had education of children at the forefront before anyone else was doing it and started teaching children about who they are as Native people.
John Graham is currently fighting extradition from Canada to stand trial for the murder of Annie Mae. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Rapid City, South Dakota.
3,000 members of the AFL-CIO braved the freezing rain on Capitol Hill, calling on Congress to halt the loss of U.S. industrial jobs. John Hamilton has more from the Workers' Independent News Service.
Union members want lawmakers to reverse the hemorrhaging of U.S. manufacturing jobs, 2.6 million of which have disappeared or moved overseas since George W. Bush took office 3 years ago.
With friends like President Bush, who the hell needs enemies?
Linda Chavez-Thompson is executive vice president of the AFL-CIO.
The Bush administration has destroyed more manufacturing jobs than all the jobs in the entire city of Sacramento, California, plus all the jobs in Dayton, Ohio, plus every single job in the entire states of Delaware and New Hampshire.
With America's unions still losing members faster than they can organize new ones, the IUC is also lobbying for Senator Edward Kennedy's proposal to make it easier to join unions, the Employee Free Choice Act. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Following President Bush's lead, British Prime Minister Tony Blair has called for an independent inquiry to investigate the quality of British intelligence over the dubious claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction before last year's invasion. Reversing his opposition, Blair says the investigation will focus on whether the pre-war information was accurate. Liberal Democrats in Parliament are calling the investigation incomplete because it may not examine the political decision to wage war. In the United States, President Bush says he'll appoint a bipartisan commission to investigate the pre-war failure of intelligence, but Democrats on Capitol Hill say that Congress, too, should appoint members to ensure a credible investigation. FSRN's D.C. editor Mitch Jeserich reports.
President Bush has changed course, and now he says he'll appoint a commission sometime this week to investigate grave errors in the pre-war intelligence on Iraq. The White House will choose all 9 of the members to be on the commission, which is causing great debate on Capitol Hill in an election year. But Senator Trent Lott, a Mississippi Republican, says he doesn't think it is a conflict of interest for Bush to choose the commissioners that may end up investigating the administration itself.
A lot of people saying, let's hang somebody's scalp out to dry. While I might be willing to do that, I don't think that should be our main focus. So, if the president wants to do an independent commission by executive order and he picks really well-respected former intelligence people, maybe future former heads of the CIA or FBI or judges or whatever, I think that that commission will be judged to a degree by the quality of the people he picked.
Bush says the process in creating the commission will resemble the 1963-64 Warren Commission, which Lyndon Johnson appointed 7 people, headed by former Chief Justice Warren, to investigate the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The White House says the commission will decide for itself whether to look into the charge that the Bush administration manipulated the information to justify war. Bush says his appointees will be impartial. One name already circulating as a possible commissioner is Robert Gates, former CIA director under the first President Bush. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who supported the invasion, is doubtful that a panel stacked with Bush appointees will carry any credibility.
And the only way it can have credibility is if it has members submitted by both Democrats and Republicans from the Congress as well.
You have access to classified information. You've seen information. A lot of the other lawmakers have seen information that most other people don't get to see. And yet, of course, you did support the initial invasion of Iraq. Is it possible that Bush as well saw much of the same information and that he too made a mistake like everyone else?
The president and the administration own the intelligence. They get intelligence that we don't get, and we don't see what they saw necessarily.
In an interview with the Washington Post, Secretary of State Colin Powell said he does not know if he would have supported an invasion of Iraq if he knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. He continued, however, that Iraq intended to create such weapons, and he said it was the right thing to do. Intention, however, is not what Powell told the UN last year, says Joe Cernincione with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. And he says there was plenty of evidence that Iraq did not have the weapons before the invasion.
But we were getting a great deal of intelligence from the UN inspections as soon as they began back in November 27th of 2002. Much of that intelligence we simply ignored. We had tremendous surveillance capabilities, but we didn't have people on the ground. Well, after November 27th, there were people on the ground. And these inspectors went to many of the facilities where they had been said there was suspicious activity in the nuclear and chemical areas in particular, and they reported back that they found nothing. And on the eve of the war, the Director General of the IAEA directly refuted some of the major claims that Powell also presented in his presentation on the nuclear systems.
Greg Tillman retired last year as former director of the Office of Strategic Proliferation and Military Affairs in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. Tillman says Bush's own intelligence agencies reported that it was unlikely Iraq was close to developing a nuclear weapon and that Saddam Hussein probably had no connections to al-Qaeda.
I wish that David Kay would have acknowledged that on the Iraqi missile program, the intelligence community professionals in the detailed language of the estimates were very close to the mark about what Iraq was doing. and I think they can be proud of that. They also, in terms of what they said about the connection between Saddam and al-Qaeda, they were essentially correct as far as we can tell. They were not the ones to create the impression of a close link here. It was that came from elsewhere.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Halliburton announced yesterday that it would repay the government for overcharges estimated at $16 million for meals served to U.S. troops at a military base in Kuwait last year. Last month, Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root disclosed that two employees had taken kickbacks from a Kuwaiti subcontractor who was providing services to U.S. troops. The company reimbursed the government $6.3 million. KBR has also been accused of overcharging for gasoline shipments to Iraq under a military contract. In other news from Iraq, a delegation of trade unionists has recently returned from visits to Baghdad for a series of meetings with the newly formed Democratic Iraqi Trade Unions. The trip was organized by the Stop the War Coalition and hosted by the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions and was the first of its kind since the U.S. occupation began. Sarah Turner reports.
I will send you a proposal to double the budget of the National Endowment for Democracy and to focus its new work on the development of free elections and free markets, free press, and free labor unions in the Middle East.
Despite this assurance from President Bush during his January 2004 State of the Union address, it is still illegal to organize a union in Iraq. The situation of Iraqi unions was witnessed firsthand by an international delegation of trade unionists who visited Iraq in October 2003. The delegation visited three plants, speaking to both managers and workers. Employees at the Al Daurah oil refinery are receiving a mere $60 per month in wages and are forced to work without adequate safety equipment. One delegate was Clarence Thomas, an officer with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and a member of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.
The workers told us that during the Saddam Hussein regime, that they received profit sharing, bonuses, they receive money for housing allowance and other supplemental income, which in some instances match their salaries.
In June 2003, labor activists came out of hiding to attend a union convention in Baghdad to determine the future of Iraq's labor movement. 400 labor organizers attended this event and decided to form 12 separate unions, one for each of the major industries in Iraq. That same month, the U.S.-run Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, issued Public Notice Number 1.
Public Notice Number 1 says that anyone who advocates anything that causes civil disorder will be taken and treated as a prisoner of war under the Geneva Convention.
Labor journalist David Bacon was also a member of the labor delegation. He spoke with union members attempting to collectively bargain with their employers and learned almost all factories in Iraq belong to the government, which is now effectively the CPA. Whenever workers ask for contract negotiations, says Bacon, they are shot down.
The answer that came back from Paul Bremer and from the CPA was, under the Iraqi labor code and a provision issued by Saddam Hussein in 1987, workers in the public sector in Iraq and state-owned enterprises are not really workers. They're civil servants. They're not entitled to organize unions, and they're not entitled to bargain. These unions don't exist. You may not talk to them.
The CPA also reduced wages for public employees down to $40 per month. Workers at the Southern Oil Company refused to accept the cuts and threatened to stop oil production at the only industry actually exporting oil from Iraq.
One of the first big labor victories of the Iraqi labor movement last week, the Coalition Provisional Authority and the Oil Ministry announced that they would begin paying workers according to the wage schedule that the workers themselves had demanded.
On December 10th, the CPA went beyond refusing to recognize Iraqi unions and engaged in direct intimidation.
They took eight members of the executive board of the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. They detained them. They sprayed black paint over the place where it had the name of the union on the outside of the building. They tore down the posters that were on the walls inside the rooms, and they took the files of the union.
One of the eight union leaders detained was Subi al-Mashindani, General Secretary of the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. Just prior to the destruction of his union headquarters late last year by U.S. troops, he accepted an ILWU pin from Clarence Thomas, calling on working people in the United States to provide financial and political help to Iraq's fledgling trade union movement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner.
Over 1.5 million veterans vote in primary elections today in 7 states around the country, and their votes could make the difference, especially in Arizona and South Carolina, where veterans make up high percentages of voters. The campaigning has seen Vietnam veterans Senator John Kerry and General Wesley Clark stressing their military service. Kerry regularly peppers his speech with remembrances of his, quote, band of brothers on a swift boat down the Mekong, while Wesley Clark rarely misses an opportunity to mention he was shot 4 times. But on the campaign trail in the Southwest, only Congressman Dennis Kucinich has made a trip to a Native American reservation. Native Americans serve in the military at higher rates than whites. And as Nock Nguyen and Aaron Glantz report from the Navajo Nation, despite some recent recognition, many Native American veterans continue to feel discrimination.
Hundreds of people pack into a high school gym in Page, Arizona, many decked out in traditional dress with feathers, seashells, and bells. Women, children, and elders dance to the beat of drum circles as Native American veterans receive a standing ovation from the crowd, while these soldiers from World War II and the Vietnam War have waited decades to receive their due. Another soldier, Lori Piestewa, is making headlines. The Marine and Hopi from Tuba City, Arizona, a single mother of 2 young children, in April became the first Native American woman to die in combat. Arizona's governor honored Piestewa by giving her name to a mountain previously called Squaw Peak. Veteran Jennifer Gray Mountain, Anishinaabe and Ojibwe from Michigan, was at the powwow.
I think it's about damn time they did something to honor Native Americans because of what they've done in the military. And I think that Squaw Peak was a really derogatory term. And in French, it was the word that the French used to ask for Native women to be whores. And so why would we want to call it an Indian whore peak?
Navajo Gitson Jones aided U.S. Armed Forces during the Vietnam War as a radio operator. He says despite the spotlight on Piestewa, little is being done to solve the problems American Indian veterans face on the reservation. Jones, a victim of post-traumatic stress disorder, says veterans have to travel long distances to receive care at VA hospitals far from the reservation.
A lot of our Native people, they love to be around here on their homelands and closer the land, because a lot of our Navajo Native people, they do not speak the English language fluently. So whenever they get out there, they usually have problems.
Jones also says veterans lack adequate housing because the GI Bill only helps veterans buy homes outside of tribal lands. Overall, he says Native Americans are only eligible for 3 of the 42 provisions of the GI Bill. Emmett Levtan says he still hasn't received compensation for his exposure to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. He says the defoliant has made his whole family sick.
I went through 2 operations a few years back, and then they detected some type of a growth inside my stomach. My youngest daughter, she would have been about 26. She died of leukemia. And then my other 2 daughters, they're older. One's 32 and one's 30. They think they have cancer. And my boys, they come down with rash and stuff like that.
Jennifer Gray Mountain says many older veterans, like her own father, returned to live on the reservation after their service. There, they were isolated and did not know about benefits, so many of them only recently received compensation. Like Gray Mountain, many young tribal men and increasingly women are signing up for military duty to get money for college, to travel, and to escape the stifling poverty of reservation life. According to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, 1/2 of Native Americans are unemployed. 1/3 of them are living in poverty.
You know, I hear a lot of people say, the government has done so much to Native Americans. Why would you join and serve the government? We're not thinking about it as serving the government. We're thinking about it as doing our part to protect our country, because, you know, our religion, Native American religion, is tied to this land, and we have to protect that. Otherwise, you know, we have prophecies and stories that say if we don't do our job to protect it and to take care of it, then it's going to be gone.
But Gray Mountain, now a 3rd grade teacher, says for her, the meaning of the word warrior is changing.
Now, the modern day warrior is the person that leaves and joins the military, or that even leaves the reservation and goes and gets an education and tries to bring new ideas and bring back education to the reservation to upgrade our people, to make them stronger.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nak Nguyen with Aaron Glantz on the Navajo Nation in Page, Arizona.
Days after Timothy Stansbury Jr., the 19-year-old New York City youth who was shot and killed by a housing cop, was laid to rest, some New Yorkers took to the streets protesting his death. New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly said the officer's action was, quote, unjustified. And the Brooklyn District Attorney Charles Hines said that he will seek a grand jury indictment against the officer. For the protesters, Timothy Stansbury Jr. was one more in an ever-increasing list of black youth who've been wrongfully killed by law enforcement. From WBAI in New York, FSRN's Ian Forrest has the story.
What do we want?
Justice!
In whose street?
Our
streets!
What do we want?
Justice!
A group of New Yorkers marched through the snow-lined streets of Bedford-Stuyvesant from Brooklyn's Restoration Plaza to the complex at which Timothy Stansbury Jr. was recently shot by a housing cop, Richard Neary. Their message, enough is enough.
This demonstration is a demonstration first and foremost to say to the police department, to say to Raymond Kelly, that the orders of should shoot to kill our black youth and Latino youth, we are not going for.
Amawale Clay is with the December 12th movement, one of the organizing groups of the demonstration, calling for more than what he says is the surrender of Neary. What he wants is the removal of a system that produces the actions of cops like Neary.
We know that young Timothy Stansbury Jr. was not killed because he was young Timothy Stansbury Jr. He was killed because he was a young black man. And so our response is not going to be as if this is simply a question of the murder of one child. It is the murder of many of our children over a long period of time, of egregious crimes against our people, just so we will also not let them put this on one police officer. And as they say, give him up to hide the real injustice in our community.
Charles Barron, a New York City Council member seeking the New York City mayorship, went on record to call for residency requirements for city cops in the areas that they serve, saying that black and brown communities of New York needed people who understood their culture to effectively police them.
We want those who are committed to us in our neighborhood. Another thing we have to do, we have to make sure we have an independent agency that prosecutes police. If they cuss you out and call you out of your name, they should be fired. If they beat you up unnecessarily, they should be charged with assault. And if they take your life, they should be charged with murder, manslaughter, reckless endangerment, something to put them in jail for the rest of their lives.
On reaching the housing development in which Stansbury was shot, protesters faced the building and with fists raised, observed a minute of silence for the fallen youth. Sonia Fatima, who works at a local high school, says the workings of the system universally sends the wrong messages to the youth.
I see their frustration. I see their feeling that there is no power except the power of money. I see them internalizing all that's happening to them, their anger, their rage, they're turning it against each other. That's why I come out here and demonstrate. I hate demonstrating around these kind of things. I want to celebrate our successes.
Eighth grader Brendan Walker watched the march with two of his schoolmates. He says the police do not have respect for black people and believes that that needs to change.
They think that black young men are grown up to be thugs, hang on string, go to jail, but some of them, that's not the point.
What is the point?
The point is, you know, you should respect one another. You want respect, you know, power of, you know, the races, you know, we should have that.
Timothy Stansbury Sr., father of the slain youth, says that what he wants now is action.
I'm not looking for no more sorriness or no more nothing like that. I'm looking for action. I'm looking for this man to be indicted. He stood up to be a police officer. He did wrong, so he got to do the time.
The possibility of a grand jury indictment against Officer Neary is no guarantee that he will be convicted of a crime and do time. The officers involved in the shooting death of the unarmed Amadou Diallo, who was shot 19 times, though indicted, were never convicted. Reporting for FSRN, I am Ian Forrest in New York.
Recently, a 10-day sit-in at the back entrance to the state building of Maharashtra in Mumbai, India, ended. The protesters' demands, met in part by the government, included a moratorium on big dam construction along the Narmada River, about 5 hours north of Mumbai. Max Sussman reports.
The decision to hold a dharna, or sit-in, began over a month ago, when the Narmada Control Authority agreed to permit construction that would raise the dam height from 100 to 110 meters. This act would submerge at least 12,000 families in over 70 villages in the dam's reservoir area. According to an earlier Supreme Court decision, all previously displaced people must be resettled before any new construction can occur. This has not happened, says Meta Patkar, founder of the NBA.
You see, when the Supreme Court gave a decision on the Sardar Sarovar Dam on the River Narmada in October 2000, it did approve the dam, but it also said that beyond 90 meters, the dam should not proceed without completing the rehabilitation and environmental measures. It was obvious that even at that particular point of time, in Maharashtra, Madhya Pradesh, as well as Gujarat, there were many, many families who were affected at 80 meters height but not rehabilitated. So the dam should not have proceeded. And yet, after the judgment, twice the dam was raised to 95 first and then to 100.
During the last 6 days of the dharna, four activists went on hunger strike to communicate the seriousness of their claims to the government.
Fasts were undertaken many times between 1990 and 2003, whenever there was a critical phase, and we wanted something that was critical at that point of time to be accepted. So it was a moral appeal, raising one's own level of conscience and also appealing to the conscience of the government on one hand and the people at large on the other.
There are over 3,000 dams of different sizes along the Narmada River, which spans over 1,300 kilometers in the states of Maharashtra, Madhya Pradesh, and Gujarat. The largest of these, the Sardar Sarovar, was the dam in question this week. It has already submerged tens of thousands of families, and its continued construction threatens more.
33 villages in Maharashtra are going to submerge because of Sardar Sarovar Dam. So basically 3,000 families from Maharashtra only are going to submerge without rehabilitation. So our demand was just to stop the dam because our rehabilitation is not yet been done.
But even those who have been resettled in the rehabilitation sites face other problems. They have been uprooted from their land and livelihood, explains Kavel Singh Wasave.
We have seen people who got rehabilitated from since 1992. Some people got rehabilitation. Some of them are quite happy, but many of them having different kinds of problems, basically of land, getting work. So it's very hard. I mean, we can't imagine our future in the rehabilitation sites where we lost nature, our culture, our family, society, and religion. So we can't say that we'll be happy in the rehabilitation sites. We'll just see. We'll try.
The sit-in won the NBA and thousands of families a small victory, as the Maharashtra government agreed to hold off on further construction until all those who are facing submergence are resettled. Tonight, hundreds of villagers returned home, bringing this news and hoping that this time, the government will hold true to its word. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Max Sussman in Mumbai, Maharashtra, India.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.